Good morning, everyone. How's everyone feeling? Sleep well? Yeah? Get your bellies a little bit full. I want to just begin with just a little bit of processing. You know, I don't know if you maybe picked this up yesterday, but generally people tend to be either external processors or internal processors. I'm a little bit of both, but I mostly am an external processor, which is what helps me to do stuff like this, because I think on my feet really quickly and I discover what I think and what I believe as I'm saying it. And a lot of us are like that. Others of us need to really internalize something, go be alone for a while, digest, chew, and then take it out and maybe think about it. So obviously this format, especially as we interact with one another, favors people who tend to process quickly and externalize their thoughts in very easy ways. And on the other hand, people who process internally can sometimes feel overwhelmed and not have the ability to get a word in. So let me offer this invitation as a way of kind of reconnecting where we were yesterday with where we're going to be and go today. For those of you who needed to get away and allow things to sink in the wake of our two sessions yesterday, session one about being lost and session two last night about engaging story and what gets in the way of engaging story, any reflections or observations or comments that you'd like to perhaps share coming out of our time yesterday? Comments, aha moments, knit brow moments? None? Another round of coffee for everybody. No? Okay, any of you external processors? want to jump in? Any follow-up reflections from our time yesterday? Yeah, go ahead. So his comment is he appreciated the tree metaphor. What in particular was powerful or helpful for you about that?
Your comment that it might be possible that some of the Baptists and the Catholics might have more comment there.
Okay, good. I used three different tree metaphors, so I wasn't sure which one you were talking about. The cross-section of the tree, that there are some people within the Roman Catholic tradition and the Southern Baptist tradition that, depending on where they are in the depth of that, have more in common with maybe even people in their own tradition. Have you experienced that even personally? In your congregation as well, yeah. Good, good. Any other comments or?
I would add to that, just to you're talking about any species that isolates itself will be destroyed.
Yeah.
Or eventually.
Yeah.
But in that, you've got this cross-pollination going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And experiencing that, but just the beauty of that, realizing how much that's helping us to grow stronger.
Yeah. His comment about the biological speciation thing, that the more isolated a species gets, the more likely it is to lose its ability to reproduce, produce deformities and those things. And so it's in the ability to host diversity within an ecosystem that life can really be profoundly verdant, life-giving, generative in those ways. And boy, I know, for me, I've experienced that on such a profound level, both in the Jacob's Well community, because we have people from very diverse, different backgrounds that, for whatever reason, are able to host that in this space as a community that has been really generative for me personally, and I think for our community broadly. But honestly, that's another thing, too, that's been for me so powerful about the emergent conversation, is that people want to pin it down as what this is what emergent people believe, and I'm really, who are you talking about? Because emergent isn't so much a brand or a particular bag of tricks like we talked about yesterday, as it is a space that allows people to have conversations that their normal spaces won't allow them to have. Oftentimes people have to get out of their primary spaces in order to engage the questions and the struggles that they themselves are experiencing. And honestly, that's how emergent even developed. It was a group of us who in our local context felt like we were all drowning. And we found each other over a period of a number of years, and what the way I use the metaphor is that it felt like we'd scratch ourselves to the surface, we'd get together and it'd be like we'd been breaking the surface, got a big gulp of oxygen, and then went back down. The idea that we could get together and process, what are you thinking, what are you asking, what are you reading? And that cross-pollinization became very creative, collaborative, and gave us permission to ask questions that we didn't know other people were asking, and that was an enormously good gift. Let me retrace as we start in this morning's session, and we are going to go hard this morning. We've got a lot of material to cover, and because we usually have our best energy at the start of the day, even though we don't believe that we do, man, I'm telling you what, coming back and trying to focus after lunch, that's a challenge. When I was an art major at the University of Kansas, we had art history class, and it seemed like the art history class I always had was at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, which meant I had gone back to my place to live, fed myself something to eat, went into the basement of this art history museum, sat in these plush, comfortable theater seats. The professor dimmed the lights and started showing us slides of art. Forget it. I mean, just whoom, boom. I was out. It was nap time, you know? So in that sense, we're really going to go hard this morning and then create some more space that afternoon as we talk. Retracing our steps thus far. Session one, the idea that we are in a time, all of us, of feeling disoriented, at least disoriented, if not completely lost. And the task before us is the task of remapping, of discovering not what's going on in the environment and how can we do violence to the environment to match our previously existing mental maps, but how can we be fully present to ourselves and our environment where we find ourselves today in order to engage the reality of what's happening around us. We find ourselves, and that allows us to orient no matter where we are. Okay, that was the first session. Then yesterday evening in session two, we talked about all the things on the first half of the conversation that keep us from being able to reorient. We talk about the fact that things like enlightenment epistemology, ministry bag of tricks, the separation that happens in community, the isolation that happens between traditions, all those things mitigate against us being able to deeply engage the environment we're in. They offer a panicked people an increasing number of tools that we try to latch onto, right, in order to reorient ourselves immediately and quickly as we're adrenalized, rather than letting go of those things and entering our own stories. And so as an illustration of that, I spent some time last night telling you my story of reorienting, of the process that got me personally lost, that I'd had this profound experience in college of being mapped, of being oriented, of living in community, of having a way of life that was Christian in the midst of a campus that was not, and having an amazing community experience in that, and living life in God in a way that I assumed was normative for everybody. That this is just the way Christianity is, until I got lost. And I realized, holy cow, what I had there was profoundly unique, and it sent me on this quest of saying, what was so good? Not how do I recreate college? Boy, that would be nice, wouldn't it? But that's not a luxury that's open to me, except for the fact that now 20 years later, my Kansas Jayhawks won the national championship. 20 years after my freshman year, they did it, so just a little plug there for the Jayhawks. But not how do I recreate that experience, but what was true of our life and our way of life and our way of practicing faith then? And is that way of living available to me today and to us today? And the good news is that, I said to you, my crisis emerged when I said and shook my fist at the heavens, I cannot believe that the best days of my life as a disciple of Jesus Christ were meant to be lived between the ages of 19 and 21. Well, good news. I'm 39, and they just keep getting better. And that's the honest to God truth. The last decade of my life has exceeded what I experienced from the ages of 19 and 21. And that every day, well, not every day, maybe every other day, is an adventure. You know, in terms of engaging with God now. And so the question I asked yesterday is, where are you? What's the environment that you're existing in? And how do you engage deeply, not with what we're doing here, but what's going on in you, the narratives and the places that God has put you in his story and in the environment that you're a part of? Where are you? And how do we get there? And how do we orient around that story? So a couple quotes. Paul, you asked the question yesterday, and it was a really great question, and I think it's important to deal with it. The idea that for some people, they're so lost that the ability to just reproduce even just something gets them a little bit further down the road. You know, is it bad for everybody to kind of just reach into that bag of tricks once in a while to help orient them? And the answer may be maybe not. But it's interesting because this conversation is not just happening in the church. It's happening in corporate America as well. And this, again, from Meg Wheatley in Finding Our Way. She asked the question, why do so many people in organizations, or I could say churches, feel so discouraged and fearful about the future? Why does despair only increase as the, what's it say? Fads fly by. shorter in duration, more costly in each attempt to improve. Why have the best efforts to create significant and enduring organizational change resulted in so many failures? We and our organizations exist in a world of constant evolutionary activity. We're constantly having to remap. Why is change so unnatural in human organizations? She goes on to say that one of the reasons it is because we live in a mechanized world, that we see ourselves and our organizations as machines, as opposed to organic realities. And so as organic creatures in organizations that flow organically out of the reality of who we are as human beings, these mechanized metaphors, and we'll get into some of this afternoon, become for us life-destroying, not life-generating. And it's what makes change so hard. Machines do not deal well with change, right? Factories operate on precision. You interchange the cogs, the parts. Well, guess what? We're not machines. We're not interchangeable. We're dynamically engaged with one another, and we're creating an organism out of which life either flows or does not flow. So, one more quote before we jump in. I love this. Read this with me out loud, will you? Choose life, only that and always, and at whatever risk, to let life leak out, to let it wear away by the mere passage of time. To withhold giving it and spreading it is to choose nothing. Going through the motions versus waking up. You know the word in the New Testament for repent. I think that's an unfortunate translation, repent, in our culture. The Greek is actual metanoia. Now, you can get an idea of what metanoia means by its opposite, paranoia. Paranoia is to collapse inward on oneself, to have the world decrease in possibilities till you're so singularly isolated and removed from any measure of influence that's good and life-giving that you just wither up and die. So now contrast metanoia. Forget the word repent. Metanoia. Wake up! Jesus says, metanoia, wake up! There's something happening right here, right now. It's in your very midst, and you can't even see it. The kingdom of God is right here. It is? It's an alternate reality that has at the center of it God in the incarnation of Jesus Christ. So, the question I have for us this morning: lost, disoriented, the need to reorient, to radically engage our environment, the things that work against that, epistemology, bags of tricks, isolation, the opportunity to engage our stories, to choose life, to listen for signs of life in ourselves, in one another, in our neighborhoods, in our communities as a sign and an indication of where God's Spirit might be at work generating life, and then participating with that. How might we begin to understand what it means to reorient, understanding the context that we have described thus far? How does GPS work? Anybody know how GPS works? Triangulation. Three points that are stable, and then you moving within those three. And as you triangulate, you know where you are at all times. I think in the same way, triangulation can help us think about how we in our day and age, how everybody in their day and age finds themselves. I think triangulation for us in the context of local churches and leadership, trying to respond to God's activity in our midst, is an overlapping set of three circles that create for us a triangulation possibility. The first is our context and our culture. And it is always our context in our culture. Who are we? Where do we live? How do we use language? What metaphors mediate reality for us? How does language affect how we perceive reality? What are the social settings that shape our values and the things that we notice as well as the things we do not? Our context and our culture is the primary indicator of how we start to triangulate. Most of us don't know where we are. We have how we live our lives, and we do that brilliantly, but we don't know how to talk about how we live our lives. And so we often use other people's language from a different time to create for us the mental maps of where we think we are. So we have how we're living, and then we have how we talk about how we're living, and they're generally far apart from one another. Okay? So the first ring, the first relationship is context and culture. Second, gospel and theology. In light of who we are, how we use language, the forms for how we interpret reality, things like our epistemology, how do those things create the grids through which we view Scripture and by which we construct theology? So many people want to say that you always start with the gospel and theology because those things are changeless. Guess what? Those things are always mediated through cultural tools. So what we do is at times we pause in our conversations and we say, what are the tools we're using to interpret these things? We make interpretive decisions all the time. Let me just tell you something. Unless you're reading the Bible in its original Greek and original Hebrew, you're making interpretive decisions. There's just no way to do it. So a way of describing this is tacit knowledge. Tacit knowledge is what you know and what you believe without knowing that you believe those things. It's like a pair of eyeglasses through which you look at the world. We get so used to having them on our face that we forget we're actually looking through lenses. So periodically, what we do is we say, do these things still focus my vision accurately? Or is it time to go get an eye exam? In the same way, context and culture are for us a set of eyeglasses through which we look at this. We don't start with gospel and theology. We have to know who we are first. What's our story? And how do we approach the reality of what we're interpreting in the text, in our theologies? And the good news is, and the thing that the tree trunk provides for us, is that it's not just who are we in relationship to where we are right now, but who are the reformers in relationship to the environment that gave them birth? Who were the College of the Cardinals in the 13th century that gave them the ability to engage where they were? What was happening with the Desert Fathers in their context? In other words, we have an open and ongoing dialogue, not just with us in our time, but with Christians in their time throughout history. How did it look like? What did it look like for people to engage radically in their own environment that created for them, like the Cistercians, an architecture, a theology, a way of living life that had integrity to who they were in response to what God was doing in their culture context? Make sense? Then the final piece of the Trinitarian triangulator, I like that, structures and church. How does where we are and what we believe then get embodied in tangible ways? Okay? Structures, systems. Folks, every one of us, whether or not we know it or not, we are constantly triangulating around these three things all the time. We all have beliefs and stories about the world we live in. We all have stories and beliefs about the nature of the gospel and what it is we think we're incarnating and proclaiming. And we all live in systems and structures that either give shape or do not give shape to those beliefs. Does that make sense? We're constantly in the process of reorienting ourselves based on these three things. So in this metaphor, I'm using a triangle. Now, here's the thing that's interesting. Man, do people love doing this. Let's get really hip and talk about contextual analysis and where we are and really be present in the culture that we're a part of. We also love doing this to a degree, gospel and theology. Let's deconstruct how we've gotten our belief systems to where they are, right? The thing that we have a hard time doing, and we're going to talk about this afternoon, is really engaging the systems and structures that host or don't host this reality. But here's the thing that's interesting. Even though we don't really want to do this work, truly, because this holds power, this is where power is held in the systems and structures, and thus the hardest to change, this is what we end up spending our most time talking about. How do I make my church more relevant? How do I make my church more missional? How do I make my dad, you know what I'm saying? All the conversation is largely around this issue of the church. In reality, what I think happens and what others think happen is that where we are with profound incarnational engagement and what we believe and how we perceive reality, again, incarnationally driven, overflow into this reality. That our systems and structures begin to emerge organically out of deep engagement with these two things. But what we mostly do is focus on how to change this thing, how to be hip and relevant, and often this thing gets left in the wayside. So what we're going to do this morning, the reason we're going to just really jam after these things is that we are going to talk this morning about the first two of those triangulating opportunities. We're going to talk about context this morning, and we're going to talk about theology, and then this afternoon we'll talk about structures. So one of the things I do want to say about here is that in the center of this Trinitarian reality, location, context, gospel, theology, systems and structures, is this sweet spot. Now the only thing about that is, man, that's a small target, is it not? The idea of being able to hit that with any measure of accuracy. So let me suggest beyond that, that if we use this grid, that there is this sweet spot that we might hit in our communities once every couple years. But the reality is, there's this margin of grace that exists somewhere in that region. And the reality is that we are often aiming just to be in the ballpark, right? That nobody lives consistently in this place because of the nature and the rapid nature of change. But what we're trying to do is be in a place here where we're just constantly navigating, what do we believe? Where are we? And does our systems and do our structures and our metaphors for who we are as a community match the massively reorienting terrain that we're navigating through? Because here's the reality, like I said last night, Jesus says, like I said, not come pull up a chair, not come build a structure. He says what? Come follow me. So if he's moving through terrain, then why do we think if we triangulate once, we're triangulated for all time? If Jesus is moving and we're moving with him, we're constantly in the process of triangulating in order to keep pace with the Messiah. And that is hard work. Quickly, comments, questions, thoughts. Yes.
One thing you're talking about triangulation and being lost.
Yes. Yeah.
It's kind of like orienting.
Yes.
Where I'm at based on these 3 points.
Yes.
Okay.
So having a moment of clarity where you know where you are can help you discern perhaps where you're going to go next. Whereas when you're lost and you're not oriented at all, every move is potentially good and potentially bad. But you just don't know. Yeah, and that's a scary place to be. Good. Any other comments? Absolutely right. Yeah. Janelle, let me say something and then you can tell me how it hits. She's just saying it seems like we always have these lenses on no matter what we're looking at, not just our theology, but our own context and culture. Yeah, this is the process of deconstruction. People who read philosophy or dabble in it assume that deconstruction means destruction, and that's not what it is at all. The idea is there's something vital that has had so much things added to it that you can't get at it anymore. So deconstruction is the attempt to pull away from something vital what has been accrued to it that is alien in some way to it. And there's no time in our life where we are not in the process of deconstruction. But that's not a choice to stop moving, to be cynical. It's a choice to continue to move. I think deconstruction, I mean, Jesus is deconstructing his system all the time. You have heard it said, but I say to you, he gets asked a question. He says, listen, if I answer the question on the terms that you've just answered it, I can only answer it in a small range of possibilities. So let me renegotiate your question. You know, you say, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? But let me elevate the dialogue to a different place, because you're living within a framework that's too small for what God's doing. So there is no time which we don't have to be available and present, and the buzzword that ought to be hitting us all by now in this conference, engaged. It's exhausting, but it's good, because we're constantly leaning forward, trying to pay attention to what God is doing and revealing in our context. And at the same time, having a healthy measure of skepticism towards what? Ourselves. In other words, what philosophers would call a hermeneutic of suspicion. Or I would say a hermeneutic of humility. We don't assume we know. So we need each other, we need our history, and we need conversations that allow us to determine where we are. Yeah, Paul. Right.
So, if I surround myself with people who are kind of thinking the same questions, we don't even, I mean, to what extent does Jacob's Well get people come from the outside and go, boy, that's really organic, but did you realize a lot of your thinking is very hierarchical and patriarchal?
Sure.
You guys, because you can't even,
so
many of you are wearing the same lenses, you don't even know that you've inherited these other systems.
Yeah.
And it's not really organic.
Right. Right. I mean, well, again, there's this attempt. There is no way that somehow we're going to be able to get such a picture on where we are that we get acontextual. What you're describing is an elevation out of our creatureliness. There's always going to be particularities. And sometimes you know what they are for yourselves, and sometimes you don't. Sometimes they're hidden, and sometimes they're apparent. So that's what conversation over time is. You begin to realize, oh, we were so engaged, dialed down, locked in over here, that we missed all these things over here. But hopefully that's the sign of a healthy community, that there's an environment that creates conversation that allows for diversity and conflict and disagreement to arise in the environment. Absolutely. See, conflict is not bad, it's a gift. The problem is that most of us don't know how to do conflict in a constructive way, only destructive. So, I mean, I haven't done it for a while, but there's been twice at Jacob's Well where I've preached on the spiritual discipline of conflict. Because if we're going to be engaging in the way that I'm describing, then we're going to disagree. We just have to. I read an article this morning on a web magazine that talked about a culture of a business that celebrates mistakes, that at once a month at their meeting, they have everybody get together and talk about their biggest mistake, and then they vote on who had the biggest mistake, and then they take that person and his family out to dinner. That's awesome. Because it says what matters here is engagement. And if we're trying things, then we ought to be making some mistakes. I mean, it's like the culture at Google. They give their engineers one day out of five to just pursue products that are completely curious to them. But that's been some of their best products have come out of the stuff that's been on the clock but not determined by Google brass. So Google Maps, Google News Aggregator, those things both came out of pet projects of engineers just chasing whims on their own. That's a healthy culture of engagement, as far as I can tell. So let's dive in. Great comments. Context. One of the things I say in my book, there are many things to know about our context, but I think the most prevalent one, and again, let me say this. I'm going to talk to you about how we are triangulating at Jacob's Well. This does not mean this is how you are triangulating in your world. I'm describing for you to understand what we're doing here, to hear our story. I want you to understand how we're engaging and perceiving reality as it relates to context and culture, theology, and structures. These may be similar for you. They may be very different for you. So when we look at our culture, I think one of the biggest things for us that we're recognizing is that we live in a post-world. Post does not mean anti. It means after. So to say I am post-teenager does not mean I am anti-teenager, although my son's 14, and so I'm tempted. No, just kidding. In other words, I'm simply what came after. You know, you have to go through stages in order to continue to grow and mature. So to be postmodern is not to be anti-modern. It's to say that modernity as a cultural phenomenon has run its course and is at the end of its life cycle as a movement of time. And so now we are post-modern. We are post-enlightenment. We are post-Christendom. We are post-liberal, post-conservative, post-Protestant, in all these different ways. There's all kinds of ways to describe this. So one of the things that's going on in our world is because modernity had such a sweeping narrative of reality for so long, had so much power, gave us so many gifts, and exacted so much of a cost, people are negotiating what does life look like in the wake of this big sweep of history, where the narratives of reality were very strong. And so to say that we are post, there are things that in our context need to be unpacked with that. The most obvious one that gets a lot of press is postmodern. There's a culture we're increasingly postmodern, which means, like we've talked about, we have a great deal of suspicion towards universal, objective, and certain. The idea that we would, as a people, would be able to have absolutes is a sign of modernity's hubris at work. It's not that there aren't absolutes. It's that as contingent creatures, we can't know things absolutely. Our knowledge is provisional. It's faith. And we exist in a community that's constantly negotiating our understandings of reality based on revelation and tradition. We're processing as a community with God and hopefully the Holy Spirit how we perceive and understand reality. There's also a great deal of suspicion towards what people call meta-narratives, overarching stories that describe reality for the majority of the people. You know what deconstructionism recognizes is that when there are meta-narratives in place, there's a whole group of people that are left out of those things. And so it's in a willingness to engage with the margins in conversation and saying, you know what? These meta-narratives, they're generally about one thing and one thing only, power. Who gets it and who does not? And the people who determine the meta-narratives generally are the ones with power. And so do you know where most of deconstructionism started? Expatriated Jews living in France after the wake of the Holocaust. They were left out of the meta-narrative of Western Europe. And in the wake of that, how do we understand what has just happened to our people? It's a suspicion towards these meta-narratives in favor of the local and the particular. Meta-narratives are stories that prescribe reality by a few for many. In the meta-narrative of the world that we've been a part of is the modern narrative of progress. But like we said yesterday, if we can just harness our knowledge and our power, we can achieve anything that we desire. What we've not recognized is that most of that has been done at the expense of the developing world. So on one hand, there's a rich few and a neglected, ignored minority. So suspicion towards these kinds of things. At the same time, not only is there suspicion towards the universal, the objective, the certain, towards meta-narratives, there's also a dismantling of systems and structures and narratives of order. We're deconstructing not just our philosophy, not just our epistemology, but the structures that have hosted those things. So, for example, for a lot of years, the academy, whatever the academy is, was where power was held. So you've got the academic elite, prescribing how education is to happen for many. What we see in a postmodern reality is the absolute divestment of power in education into what? Options. Private schools, self-education, homeschooling, all of a sudden the terms of how we educate and what intelligences we choose to lift up and ignore are being renegotiated. We see it in media. It used to be that the news corporations, ABC, CBS, and NBC, determined what was news, right? How has that been atomized with the internet? Profoundly. Everybody has the potential to be a news-gathering organization, or should I say organism. There's a couple of people blogging from the conference about their experience here. That's a news-gathering experience. They're functioning in a kind of new kind of journalism way determining what's going on. Healthcare, the exact same thing. You turned over the power of your body to a physician who is accredited by the academy. Now there's all kinds of holistic, natural, secondary, outside the system ways of taking care of oneself, because we realize just to hand our care, the care of our bodies into a system that responds largely with just writing prescriptions and that are funded by pharmaceutical companies, that there's something going on there that is not necessarily about health. It's about something else. And guess what? Think it's affecting our churches? Darn right it is. Spiritual power, mediating reality between God and people, it's no longer in the hands of a few. People are taking responsibility for themselves and exploring all kinds of different options. It's being atomized. At the same time, it's a time of profound creativity. Globalization in a postmodern world is causing us to come into contact with people that have previously been far away from us. We're recognizing the difference between ourselves and others, and that's creating an opportunity for cross-pollinization. It's also creating an opportunity for great conflict, right? Because people who have previously lived far apart from one another are now having their worldviews clash into one another. We've got a postmodern, post-Christian, post-Enlightenment, Western civilization. We've got, in many ways, a pre-modern, pre-Enlightenment, Muslim world. We're exporting our culture like crazy, and they're saying, thank you very much, we don't want to be a part of your world. We've seen your world. And we're saying, yeah, we've seen your world. We've got communities in conflict. We've got worldviews going out. It is not surprising that we're experiencing the amount of conflict we are. Because it's not just about who owns what patch of soil, although that's part of it. It's about worldviews coming up against each other, because we've previously been allowed to have geography separate us from one another. Now all that stuff's being flattened. Geography doesn't matter in many ways. It doesn't matter. So, postmodern world. We live in a post-Enlightenment world. Now, rather than talk about post-Enlightenment, I want to show you a music video that I think more than anything illustrates the reality of what we talk about when we talk about being in a post-Enlightenment world. Now, when I say Enlightenment, that time of history and philosophical orientation, especially towards epistemology, that says, here's how you know, here's how you access truth, universal, objective, certain, those kind of things. This is a video by the Black Eyed Peas. Some of you might know them. I'd like you to watch this video and think about how truth and knowledge is being accessed, and culturally, what symbols are being evoked to talk about the new reality of the world we live in. Timmy, you ready? Got the mic up? Okay.
Everybody. into it. Get stoked. I'm all get started. I'm all get started. Get started. Let's get it started. Ha. Let's get it started. In here. Let's get it started. Ha. Let's get it started. In here. Let's get it started.
Time your can't stand still, just to bang your spine.
Just
bob your head like me, Apple D, up inside your club or in your Bentley. Get messy, loud and sick. Your mind fast, no more on another head trip. So come down now, do not correct it. Let's get ignorant, let's get hectic.
Everybody, everybody, let's get into it. Get stoked,
I'm out.
Get started,
I'm out.
Get started,
get started.
Let's get it started. Let's get it started.
Ways of knowing that we see on display in that video. Brent. Intuition, for certain, explicitly so. Yeah, it's an extraordinary video. Think about the idea and the way that we have of knowing in our culture. It's largely individualistic and cognitive, yes? But here, the video is all about a reality that's profoundly somatic. It's physical. The bodies and the way the bodies are engaged is a bodily kinesthetic intelligence. It's communal. It's not one person. It's a tribe of people sharing power, sharing the microphone, passing on, jumping in and out of places. It's happening in the midst of a community of people that are together, profoundly interacting and creating environment. It's emotional in a way that's extraordinary. Now, I did look around and nobody was even doing this. You were okay. Yeah, in other words, it was rhythmic reality. You know, here's an interesting thing. The video, the song is called Let's Get It Started. Do you know that this is not its original title? That was the title it was changed to when Apple paid them enough money to redo the song so that they could use it for an iPod deal. Do you know what the original title was? And if you do, don't say it out loud. I'm just curious. Do you know what the original title is? It's not pejorative, but it's Let's Get Retarded. This is not some kind of slight against people with learning disabilities or who are born with mental challenges. They are saying something profound about the movement from an enlightenment to a post-enlightenment reality. When they say, let's get retarded, what are they saying? Well, let's actually look at the lyrics. These guys are actually more close to the world of the Bible than we are. Why? Because it's not a text-based culture, it's an oral-based culture. It's an oral tradition, and that's what we see on display here, and it is brilliant. Let's get it started, let's get retarded, what are the lyrics? In this context, in the location that we're in, there's no disrespect. We're just a part of a different reality than y'all, okay? So when I bust my rhyme, you break your neck. He goes like this, what's he saying? Taking the brain out of the equation for a little while. We're going to be intelligent in some other places than we're used to being intelligent. We got 5 minutes for us to disconnect. What's 5 minutes long? The song. We get a 5-minute view of a different reality right here. We got 5 minutes for us to disconnect from all intellect and let the rhythm affect. Lose our inhibition, follow your intuition, free your inner soul, and break away from tradition. Think they've got some brilliance? This is the same guy, by the way, who did the Obama video, Yes, We Can, Will I Am. I don't know if you've seen this viral thing that happened on YouTube with the Obama campaign. This is the same guy. Okay. Next guy says, lose control of body and soul. Don't move too fast. But you don't have to get there sooner than you can. People, just take it slow. Don't get ahead. Just jump into it. You got to start trying things before you know where you're going. Y'all hear about it, the P's? We just go do it. Get started, get stupid, don't worry. People will walk you through this. The community. You're being brought into an alternate reality. Step by step, like an infant, a new kid, inch by inch, with a new solution. We're discovering this as we go. Let's get it started. Let's get retarded. Let's get into it. Intuition, into it. It's brilliant. All that in 5 minutes. Post-enlightenment. A different way of being human in the midst of reality. A different way of knowing. We have how we live. We have how we think we live. We have how we engage. We have how we think we engage. I think we are far more down this road than most of us realize we are. And certainly if you have kids, they're really far down this road. I mean, let's think about even the imagery, the iconography of that environment. You've got two contrasting environments going on. This tall corporate buildings, the organizations, where's this thing happening? Street level. Structure versus street. Power versus ground. Okay? On one level. Now, what's interesting is, as that video is playing out, there are things crashing down all around them. What are they? Symbols of power and order. Nice suburban houses, cars, different things, pianos. The ultimate example of order. It's not that they're anti-piano, they're making a statement. The old order is passing away. We'll appropriate it in ways that are appropriate to us. But it's not going to determine how we engage. The other thing that's really intriguing, what do you notice ethnically about the makeup of the Black Eyed Peas? Hispanic guy, a black guy, a woman, and a guy that's mixed race. You can't tell what he is. And then as they are partying in the street, it looks like as much a WTO riot as it does a dance party. But the thing is there's energy and there's passion and there's excitement. When we think about context, postmodern, post-enlightenment. Descartes tried to prescribe reality with the famous phrase, cogito ergo sum, which means, I think, therefore I am. It's an interesting decision, and we understand historically why it developed the way it did. But he could have said a lot of things. He could have said, I love, therefore I am. He could have said, I believe, therefore I am. He could have said, we love, therefore we are. He said, I think, therefore I am. So he located reality in the individual who cogitates in order to know that they are a person. And that's truly one part of who we are. But is that all of who we are? We're discovering truly it is not. That we're not just eyes, we're we's. And maybe we're more we's than we are eyes. And that it's not only thinking that helps us determine and locate ourselves in reality. It's things like faith. Which, by the way, Neubigin, using Michael Polanyi, has done a brilliant job saying that even scientists don't do science like they say they do science. There's all kinds of intuitive leaps and demonstrations of faith that are happening all the time in innovation and scientific things. So scientists don't do science the way they say they do science. They engage these very same realities all the time. And that is good news. That's not anti-science. It's just integrity within science. The philosophy of science, understanding how we engage. But the other thing that's happened as a result of this cogito ergo sum revolution with the Enlightenment is that it was enabled by technology. some people ask the technology question. What's the technology that enabled the Enlightenment revolution? The printing press. All of a sudden, information is removed from the community and placed in books that now can be set on shelves. We don't need each other anymore to know things. We can go by ourselves, open a book, and get all the information we want. And that's a good gift, but it has changed the way we engage and we know. The technology of literacy has given us a new way of perceiving reality. And there have been several communications revolutions that have happened in time. The first was the development of the alphabet. Prior to that, language was ideographic or oral. Ideographic means the symbol represents the thing it says. So the Chinese symbol for man actually looks like a man. Whereas the alphabet, what you do is you string together a series of phonemes that have no relationship to the thing they represent. And then you move your eyes across a page a certain way. Well, folks, that activates our brains in certain ways that prescribe reality for us. And so for the last several centuries and even millennia, most of our brains have been engaging largely in a left brain way because of the way we engage and interpret and bring in information. But we are going through right now, based on what we have seen and what we're experiencing in our culture generally, not just an alphabetic revolution, not a print revolution that we've been living in for 4 or 5 centuries, but an image-based revolution, which is a reconnection to an Eastern world. And we experience that all the time. Why? Because when I draw this, there's no translation necessary, is there? Is that a word? It's an idea, isn't it? Right? Think about how many realities are being mediated right now, graphically. I mean, we look at that and we automatically know that that means losing baseball team. As much as I love the Kansas City Royals. See, our reality and our kids' reality is being mediated not just by text, but through images. And not just images that are coming because I have the time to draw them up here, but that are coming at them rapid fire, being edited in such a way that their brains are starting to change physiologically. They're processing information way much more quickly than we've ever known we knew how to do. As a result, most of our text-based churches go right over the top of people's heads. Why? Because physiologically, they do not have the brains for it. Their brains are being rewired in ways that are much more right-brained than they are left-brained. But most of our religious traditions are all left-brain, text-centered realities. Post-enlightenment. Left brain is linear, cognitive, abstract, text-based. Right brain, non-linear, conceptual, image-based. One of the things that really got me cranking on this was an article I read in Wired magazine a couple of years ago by a guy named Daniel Pink. It was coming out of his book called A Whole New Mind, and Wired featured an excerpt of it called Revenge of the Right Brain, and this is the illustration that accompanied the article. Cross-section of a human head. On the left hemisphere of the brain, what do we see? A cube farm filled with accountants, their heads down, crunching numbers, linear, abstract, sequential. On the right hand, a garden filled with filmmakers and people skipping rope and flying kites, right-brained reality. And he says in the article that for the last several centuries, economically, the culture that we live in has favored the left brain. But increasingly, we live in a culture where an MFA is now more important than an MBA. A Master of Fine Arts has as much value as a Master of Business Arts. I read an article in Harvard Business Review that says that very thing. Why MFAs are the new MBAs. Because we live in a culture that is now conceptually holding on to creativity as the greatest currency available to us. Pink says this, the world has changed. The future no longer belongs to people who can reason with computer-like logic, speed, and precision. It belongs to a different kind of mind. Today, amid the uncertainties of an economy that has gone from boom to bust to blah, there's a metaphor that explains what's going on, and it's right inside our heads. The left hemisphere of our brain handles sequence, literalness, and analysis. The right hemisphere, meanwhile, takes care of context, emotional expression, and synthesis. Of course, the human brain with its 100 billion cells forging 1 quadrillion connections is breathtakingly complex. Until recently, the abilities that led to success in school, work, business, and church were characteristic of the left hemisphere. They were the sorts of linear, logical, analytical talents measured by the SATs and deployed by CPAs. Today, those capabilities are still necessary. Do you hear that? It's not now marginalizing the left hemisphere of our brains. They're still necessary, but they're no longer what? Sufficient. In a world upended by outsourcing, by 2010, you know which country will hold the largest number of English speakers? India. In a world upended by outsourcing, deluged with data, and choked with choices, the abilities that matter most are now closer in spirit to the specialties of the right hemisphere: artistry, empathy, seeing the big picture, and pursuing the transcendent. Beneath the nervous clatter of our half-completed decade stirs a slow but seismic shift. The information age we all prepared for is ending. Do you hear that? Boy, was it quick. Rising in its place is what I call the conceptual age. An era which mastery of abilities that we've often overlooked and undervalued marks the fault line between who gets ahead and who falls behind. To some of you, this shift from an economy built on logical, sequential abilities of the information age to an economy built on the inventive, empathic abilities of the conceptual age sounds delightful. I gotta tell you, I'm happy to be in this world. But for others of us, not so much. Scarier than crap. If the industrial age was built on people's backs and the information age on people's left hemispheres, the conceptual age is being built on people's right hemispheres. We've progressed from a society of farmers to a society of factory workers to a society of knowledge workers. And now we are progressing yet again to a society of creators and empathizers, pattern recognizers, and meaning makers. Revenge of the right brain. Indeed. Now, he goes on to say in the book that what we don't see is some Manichaean future where on the left-hand side are the left-brain people and they're bumming, and on the right-hand brain, on the right-hand side are the right-brain people and they're ecstatic. We need those hemispheres completely engaged with one another. Paul says, the foot cannot say to the eye, I don't need you. The right brain cannot say to the left brain, I don't need you. But here's the reality. Most of our communities have unknowingly privileged that way of knowing for so long that we could stand to swing a little bit in the other direction for a while. I guarantee you, right brain creative people are spiritual people. They walk into our communities and they sniff the air and they go, is there a place for me here? And more often than not, they say, absolutely not, there is not a place for me in here. They intuit it. Or if they are in a place like that that does value it, generally what they value creative people for is propaganda. How will you illustrate my text-based point? Not how does your image or your dance or your music have a voice that is equal to what I would have to say propositionally. It's return of icon. It's return of image. Reality mediated through both text, language, oral, visual things, physical, somatic ways of knowing. It's why yoga is so powerful in our culture right now. Because we've had a Gnostic orientation towards spirituality that says it's all about the mind and a disembodied soul, that someday we'll get connected to heaven in a disembodied reality. Whereas yoga is profoundly somatic. It says the body itself wants to pray. That it doesn't have to engage the rational mind for it to be prayer. So you know the Greek word in the tradition of the church for this? Proskuneo. Prostrate oneself. We allow our bodies themselves to be the prayers. Not assuming that we've got to think about what we're saying, that our whole bodies can communicate reality without ever having to talk or think. Our bodies have knowledge, and they have ways of communicating. And we know this intuitively. We just haven't known that we know it. But our bodies talk to us all the time, especially when we abuse them, yes? Absolutely. adrenaline addiction, like we talked about yesterday, especially for people in ministry. That's why burnout is so rampant. We don't know how to listen to our bodies because we assume metaphorically our bodies are what? Machines. And what do you do with machines? Just feed them fuel. Ho-hos, Twinkies, Burger King, Gatorade, right? What are the energy drinks? Man, that's a scary phenomenon. I mean, that is the demonstration in an insane level of body as machine. I'm just going to keep raising up the octane level of the fuel. Or maybe it's lowering the octane level. I'm not sure how that metaphor works. Okay, see, let me say this. For me, getting back to my narrative, my undergraduate was an illustrator, design major in a fine arts program. I went to seminary at the age of 26 and discovered I loved academics. It scared the crap out of me. After drawing for 4 years, I was like, I'm going to have to read. And I mean, I've always loved to read. But what I discovered in seminary was I love academics. I love learning. But here was the struggle I had. When I would go into churches, they generally privileged one to the exclusion of the other. I could be an artist, but I couldn't be an academic. I could live in my heart, but I couldn't live in my head. Or on the other side, I could live in my head and be an academic, but there was no place for the artistic side of who I was. And what I wanted to create and what I wanted to help others create was a space that lived in tension, that we don't marginalize the head in order to engage our hearts, that we don't marginalize our hearts in order to engage our heads, but rather we create an environment that allows both the head and the heart to be present to one another and to each other, and then that get embodied. Our bodies are also part of the equation of our faith. Post-enlightenment. Okay, real quickly, post-Christendom. I don't think I need to do a whole lot of explication about what it means. This is the third and final post that I want to illustrate. Postmodern, in terms of, we're still now talking about context and culture. Postmodern, post-enlightenment, post-Christendom. We are no longer a part of Christendom. The idea of Christendom is that the culture needs, that Christianity needs the support of the surrounding culture in order to legitimize itself. We've talked about the death of the Constantinian worldview, that the church is propped up by the environment around it and needs to mediate power through the systems. We've been going through a long process of differentiation, church and culture. For the first 3 or 4 centuries of the church existed in the margins. Then for another 1,000 years, the church and the militaristic powers and the governmental powers were all one. We've been reeling ever since. The Reformation began to pull those things apart. You have the development not of empire, but of the city-state, where civil religion starts propping up. Each emerging state has its own state church. And then over time, with the Enlightenment playing out and literacy increasing, you've got the secularization of the culture and the absolute removal from the public sphere of church and public spirituality to what we have now is the separation of all those things, which isn't necessarily a bad thing in my mind. But what's been happening, what we see happening, especially if you listen to Christian radio, is absolute fear that we have lost our voice in the public sphere. Why? Because power has to be mediated through infiltration of structures. Now, there's a whole debate going on as what does it mean to be the church? Do we totally withdraw from the public marketplace? Do we totally engage? That's an interesting conversation. I'm using it to just say that we've been going through a process of becoming a post-Christendom-based culture. Before it was Europe, do you know what that part of the landmass was called? Christendom. Europe is a modern political, civil reality. Previously, it was Christendom. So when we did missions, what were we doing? Colonialism, power, infiltration, and reculturization of people to bring them civilization. We civilized the savages. There was no differentiation between militaristic power, worldview, gospel. It all went in one thing, and we're seeing the aftermath of that in places like Africa, in India, in the Middle East, all over the place right now. So we are post-Christendom. Yeah, Paul. Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 Well, and that's what we're seeing right now, a profound battle for the imagination and the heart of what kind of culture we're going to be. And so I think that's why a lot of people have felt like the Bush administration has been a return to something that we thought we were moving beyond. And so on one hand, you've got a lot of people saying, boy, are we glad we're back where we thought we were. And a lot of people saying, I'm ready to move to Canada. I mean, you read Anne Lamott. I mean, plan B, you know, now what after this? You know, and wherever we are politically, this is just a dynamic that's in play. And so I think reality is, here's how we say we're living, here's how we're living. I think a lot of people are post-Christendom. A lot of people are still grabbing onto them. It's a very good point. Any other comments on that? Yeah, David. Yeah. Yeah.
So are we slipping back and forth because we've got this tension, you know, where this old system, you know, to serve one worldview at one point in time no longer does?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question, and obviously this is a good plug for Brian, who's here now. This is going to be a part of the topics that we're going to engage, I'm assuming, with Everything Must Change as well, the political realities and how we engage as people of faith in this reality according to what Jesus says. Yeah.
I think some of it has to do with fear as well.
You know, fear is a huge deal.
Well, we got to go back to this.
Well, especially if we are deconstructing and taking apart old structures and powers being renegotiated and things like the Black Eyed Peas are helping to mediate reality. Boy, that is a scary place to be.
I think if we're doing it church institutionally, you just think the whole country is going to be doing it.
Yeah. So rather than seeing it as unique to politics or church, see, this idea of emergence, it's not just happening in the church, folks. It's happening everywhere in society. And people are reacting both with excitement and great deals of fear. So one of the things that Phyllis Tickle I heard say is that when you look at it historically, she's talking about the church, is that about every 500 years, there's an upheaval that goes on. And we have to renegotiate, remap, reorient in reality. And so what she said is that every 500 years, the church has a basement rummage sale. We clear out all the stuff that's gathered in the basement. We put it out. We say, oh, I still want that. That needs to go. And then we say, what do we want to hold on to? And now what do we want to recreate and engage with as well? So within that context, what we're talking about is, in some ways, the negotiation, Paul, might be a better way of saying it, of the Constantinian worldview. Where are we? Where are we going? And people moving in both directions. Susan, go ahead. Blue states. Yeah, yeah. Yes. 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 What is the power of the Obama Yes We Can video? Hope. Not fear. People don't get it. I think they don't understand how desperate people are to feel something other than fear. And I think, you know, a lot of people who come into emerging churches likewise say, this isn't all that in a bag of chips. What I think they don't realize is that what people are experiencing in churches like Jacob's Well and others is that we don't want to be a people of fear anymore. We think there's a lot to be excited about in terms of participating with what God's Spirit's doing in the world. And so we're leaning forward rather than leaning back and digging in. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to hit me, aren't you? Okay, I'm going to get ready. Versus we're going somewhere. You want to come along. You know? And that's exciting, yeah.
I think just playing with your loss metaphor too, I'm going to stay in the same place. Because if I go anywhere, I could be dangerous as opposed to I'm going to engage and try and find my way out of the wilderness, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, if I'm lost, paranoia sets in. I'm going to collapse and disengage from my environment and just try to preserve my place. Like Michael in that office video, he's going to build a tent out of his pants. Right? Versus I'm going to strap them on, lace up my shoes, and start exploring based on where I am and what I know of myself and what I remember I've been and where I might be going. Good, good. You know what? Here's the deal. We have gotten through one half of my talk, and the time for the talk is over, so I'm going to move the theology conversation into the afternoon and just ask you guys to eat a light lunch so you have some attention. to give. And what we'll do is make a few more comments about the overarching discussion of culture, the context, as we seek to triangulate around where we are and how we find this sweet spot between context and culture, gospel and our theology, and then the way our systems and structures then evolve to match those realities. We'll spend more energy this afternoon in the gospel theology piece and a little bit of time in the systems and structures. And then tonight, if we need to continue to talk about a little bit of that, we can do that. I've, like I said, loaded us up on the morning on the heavy side so that tonight we have some play with what we want to do in terms of our time and have an ability to respond to what people are feeling, hearing, or wanting to ask questions about. So in the last 5 minutes here, broad comments about the overall idea of where we are as it relates to being in a pulse culture and where either you're experiencing that in your own life or not experiencing that or see that in the world around you, or then even more broadly than that, just general comments or observations based on our conversation this morning. Yeah. Really loud if you can. I don't think that they help. Because they assume that there's some place where Christ is that's not being enculturated. There's just no way to engage Christ from an acontextual position. So show me where that place is and I'll think about it. But I just don't know where Christ is mediated that's not amongst a group of people. So I think you're right about that. Yeah. Yeah, Matt. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Need some stability. Yeah. Boy, it sounds like you're already doing it. I mean, in other words, I don't know that there's an answer to that question except to say, what a cool place to be, what a challenging place to be, and how demanding it must be for you to engage and live in both of those worlds simultaneously. I do think one of the things that we underestimate is the ability to cast vision to an older community about their ability to influence and host change in young people, not for themselves, but on behalf of another group of people. And I think that what I see in our community is a desperate longing for connection with people of a different generation. And I think one of the real honest-to-goodness things that we see happening, again, I'm the proverbial Gen X generation, which was the latchkey kid generation. I think a lot of people have felt, and this is no indictment, it's just a reality, a lot of people in this generation felt abandoned by baby boomers. And so in that sense, the desire for younger generations to be connected to older generations is quite profound, but not for the purpose of being told what to do, but for the purpose of relationship. And that's what happened with Jacob's Well in Roanoke. I mean, people think, hey, what a great deal that you guys were able to buy this building for $200,000 from this congregation and they passed the baton on for you. You know what we felt? Grief. We lost our grandparents. We loved sharing this space with those guys. And one of the happiest things that happened for us was when one of the couples, John and Ora Oliver, in their late 70s, decided to stay. And you know what service they come to? The 5:30. They're the oldest couple, it's the youngest congregation, it's the most inked, it's the most pierced, it's the most alternative crowd in the three services that we do here. And John and Ora sit in the back row and she has her earplugs in. But you know, once a month, young people from our community go over to their house and clean out their gutters, they change their light bulbs, run into them at Starbucks. Philip, next week are we having a potluck to celebrate their 60th wedding anniversary. We're sharing life. So, Matt, how do you create an environment? You know, Alan Ruxburgh, in his book, Leadership in Transition, The Sky is Falling, Leaders Lost in Translation, he talks about the idea, he calls them liminals, I think, and emergence. And he says you've got, on one hand, this old established stability-based culture, and you've got this young transitional one, and what we're missing is the Eli Samuel relationship, what he calls communitas. How do we create environments that allows both to contribute one to another? And I think that's really critical. And oftentimes, here's what I think leadership is. The ability to hold in yourself tension that other people can't yet hold because they don't get it. So leaders have the ability to use their power to mediate space. So you may not trust her, but you trust me and you trust me. So together, we live in this space till you begin to trust one another. Versus how do you all look to me and I take you someplace you don't want to go? How do I use the power that I have by emptying myself of it in order to create space where conversation can happen? Trust is the absolute key. Right. It's certainly a language. It's hospitality. Making space in myself for the other. Which goes back to what we talked about last night, vulnerability. See, what most leaders have done is said, I'm invulnerable to you. Versus, I display my weakness. Not in order to get your sympathy, but in order to model the kenotic reality of Christ. Who, though he had power, he emptied himself of power in order to create something that couldn't be accessed through power. Leadership has largely been about the acquisition and the deployment of power. Let's all be honest. Leaders have power. The question is, what do we do with it? Do we deconstruct ourselves? Do we allow other people to deconstruct us? Do we give away what we have in order to privilege others who might not have a voice otherwise? Here's the thing that's fascinating. You look in the Bible, anytime a culture gets unresponsive, gets lost and unable to respond to what God's Spirit is doing, who does God raise up to be his voice? People from the margins, women and children, over and over and over again. In the story of Moses and Israel's captivity and exploitation by Egypt, it's Moses' mother and a child that become the catalyst for the deliverance of Israel. When Israel is lost and unresponsive and God hasn't spoken for generations, Hannah and Samuel. When they want to talk about the greatest king in Israel's history, David, the book of Ruth traces David's genealogy backwards to what? A foreigner. A woman who displays hesed reality that Israel's lost sight of. So it's Ruth and her baby that changed the dynamics in the reality of what's going on. In the New Testament, Elizabeth and John, another time of silence when God hasn't spoken for generations. And all of a sudden, an angel appears to Zacharias in the temple, and he's so shocked that God speaks like Eli is, that he doesn't respond well, and so God says, well, I'm speaking, so you're not. Mary and Jesus in the book of Revelation, the woman and the child battling the dragon. All the time, it's from the margins that God speaks. The question is, will those in power who inhabit the structures and the systems listen to the voice of the marginalized? And I would even say, will those of us in power listen to the marginalized parts of ourselves that we've learned to ignore? Will those who have the mastery of the left brain realities allow the creative and the artistic to have a voice? I mean, here's what I think happens at Jacob's Well. This is just anecdotal. Creative people walk in here, and they go, holy crap. This place actually values creativity. It's not, I can just feel it. I smell it. So most places have a problem attracting people who are creative. We have too many. We need some left-brain people to help impose some order on the chaos and the life that we're experiencing. That's a good thing. Most people have the skeleton and no flesh, no organs. We've got this pile of flesh and organs sitting on the floor looking for some skeleton to help animate this thing so we can move a little bit more fluidly, right? It's both those things together. So, most of us have organizations that go searching for signs of life. Other people have life looking for some organization to help make it take the next step. Good. Any other final comments, questions in light of this conversation? Yeah, David.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes. The structure. Yeah. Yeah. The e-myth. Right. Well, I don't know that safety is ever a luxury that we're afforded.
Sure.
It's part of the entrepreneurial apostolic innovator's dilemma that you move out into chaos before you know that there's something there to catch you. It's like, I mean, not to use too goofy a metaphor, but Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade, you know, it's him going like this and stepping out onto the deal and hoping that there's something there. And guess what? We're going to fail. We're going to make mistakes. But can we celebrate those things? And I know when you're starting a business, the stakes are very high because it's been capitalized or, you know, there's something going on in terms of trying to do something. I mean, it is a dilemma. Now, let me say this as it relates to this idea. This is happening on a continuum. It's not that we're all the way here and all the way here, and there's this big divide that has to be jumped over once we have these things established. This is an ongoing conversation that's constantly happening. I'm breaking it as if there are very separate things, but the reality is they're not very separate things. They're actually far more like this. You see what I'm saying? I mean, they're constantly informing one another and making adjustments all the time. And so the question is how are we listening to what's going on and responding to those things? And I think for the purpose of talking about it, we're breaking them apart and making them further from one another than they are. But the reality is almost from the beginning, we're organizing ourselves in structures immediately. There's just no way not to. But the question is how are we doing that? How aware of the fact that we're doing that? And here's even more important to me. What metaphors are we using? Because the reality, and we'll talk about this afternoon in structures, most of us come out of metaphors that are shaped largely in the Industrial Revolution or the organizational age. Mm-hmm. And as a result, those things don't have fluency with the kind of contextual and theological, and I don't mean theological in purely a religious way, I mean our perceptions of reality. How do our systems and structures reflect the reality of where we are? And what metaphors are available to us beyond the idea of behemoth, of massive bureaucratic structure in the light of the fact that in order to be responsive in our culture today, you've got to be fast and loose. And even the big organizations, man, you read best practice magazines, you read what's on the cutting edge of corporate literature, Meg Wheatley, all these things. They're saying this exact stuff. All the quotes that I'm giving you today from the are coming out of Meg Wheatley's book, Finding Our Way, and I do that to say, this is not just a creative reality. The companies that are really thriving in the marketplace are engaging these intuitive realities as well. It's an issue of emergence. Things are rising out of the environment, not just in the church, but in social justice environments, in corporate environments, in filmmaking environments, in all these different places, in healthcare, in education, and some systems, like we said last night, are reorienting and remapping and deeply engaging, and others are resisting and digging in like crazy. And sometimes that works for a while because they've got a lot of resources to expend, because they've been in power long enough, they have these things called foundations that underwrite things, and so the signs of decay are masked by the funding that happens to cover those things. But a day of reckoning will come. Or, by the sheer weight and the power of their strength, they will overcome something else. And they'll win, but they'll kill life in the process. So, okay, let's break. We're going to groups. Is that right? So back to the places you were. If you were here this morning for the first time, in other words, you got into the conference today and you don't know where you're to go, date is right here. And if you'll find date, he will tell you where you're to be.